Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, cities are starting to take on extreme heat, but are they going about it the right way?
And we talk propositions and one that aims to address the public nuisances of homelessness.
But first, retired Pima County Superior Court Judge John Leonardo sent a lot of people to prison in his long career on the bench. But there's one case that still haunts him. The defendant was Carl Ray Buskey, an aviation mechanic with almost no criminal record, who was convicted for the possession of 29 printed images of child pornography. Judge Leonardo sentenced him to prison for 290 years. He had to, because Arizona law required his sentence not be less than 10 years for each image. It was a reprehensible crime that received a disproportionate sentence, Leonardo argues in a recent opinion piece for the Arizona Republic. Now, 17 years later, he and eight other retired Pima County judges are working with the University of Arizona Law School on an application to commute Buskey's sentence, which is now pending before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. And he's calling on the legislature to change the law that allowed it to happen. I spoke with him more about it.
Well, it was not a particularly unusual case. The only thing that makes it unusual as a case is the statute that it's charged under, which requires such a draconian sentence if you're convicted. And the sentences, if you have more than one image, each sentence has to run consecutive, one after the other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it so devastating.
So, I mean, I have to say, like, a lot of people will hear this and say, like, you know, this is a terrible thing. Like, child pornography is abhorrent and should be prosecuted and should be punished.
Well, of course it's abhorrent. And I don't mean in any sense to be an apologist for those who use child pornography. But our system of criminal justice, one of the basic premises of it is that punishment ought to be commensurate and proportionate to the crime that you've committed. And it seems to me that to give somebody, in essence, is a life sentence for the possession of child pornography images is way beyond the pale of what would be an appropriate sentence.
How does that mandatory sentencing requirement there for these charges in Arizona compare with like what might happen in another state or even from what happens in federal law?
Yeah, and under federal law, someone who's charged with the same thing, possession, and I want to make it absolutely clear here, we're talking about simple possession. We're not talking about somebody who manufactured the pornography or sold it to someone or imported it. Under federal law, anything of that nature, the maximum sentence that can be imposed is 5 years. And all of the, no matter if you had one image or 100 images, it could be charged as one offense. It is one offense. It's not 100 offenses.
Hmm.
So the maximum he would have faced under federal law would be 5 years in prison. Many other states, most other states have much less serious penalties for this kind of offense. And it always struck me as odd that if you have a possession offense, in other words, you possess something that's illegal because it's harmful to society and it's harmful to the possessor a lot of times. For instance, dangerous drugs. If you possess a dangerous drug, whether it's fentanyl, heroin, whatever, the offense of possessing is different and has a different penalty than if you manufactured the fentanyl or you imported the fentanyl or you sold the fentanyl. Those are all higher degrees of culpability because they reflect a greater potential danger to society than the mere possession. But our child pornography laws in Arizona don't make those distinctions. To possess it or sell it or create it or import it, the same penalty, which makes no sense to me. And that's where it's not proportionate.
Right. So you're talking about these mandatory sentencing laws. Can you put that into context for us? Like, how common are those kinds of sentencing requirements in Arizona?
Arizona criminal sentencing has a certain structure to it, and for almost all offenses, the law specifies a range of possible sentences that a judge can impose. Most of the time, as a judge in my 19 years as a judge imposing criminal sentences, I always felt that the range that the law provided was pretty reasonable. Not that I always agreed with it, but this particular offense has a sentence it's really an embarrassment to me, to the criminal justice system, that this kind of a sentence can be imposed for this kind of activity.
How do those kinds of sentencing laws get passed? Like, is this where politics injects itself and how a judge can carry out these decisions?
Well, I don't know about the specific legislative history of how this one was passed, but I know from just experience that oftentimes politicians, they want to be seen as tough on crime, mm-hmm. especially offenses that relate to abuse of children of any sort. And so I think politics does certainly play a role.
Let me ask you about like where rehabilitation comes into that as well as a judge when you're thinking about sentencing.
As a sentencing judge, you usually find three types of people that appear before you in criminal court for sentencing. And one kind is so embarrassed that they're there at all, and it's such an aberration in their life in general that they'll never be back, no matter what kind of sentence you give them. Mm. And then on the other hand, there are people who've lived outside the law with such disregard for the law their whole lives. It doesn't matter what you do to them, they're going to continue to violate the law. And then you have that middle group, which I think is the largest of the three groups, where people that can be affected by the sentence you give. If you give the appropriate sentence, you may cause them to be rehabilitated, cause them not to commit criminal acts in the future. But that's a delicate balance, because if you give too much, you can break somebody. If you put somebody in prison, they're just going to learn how to commit crimes more effectively than they did before.
Hmm. Okay, so let me ask you lastly about what's happening now. So now you are seeking a commutation for this man, for Carl Ray Buskey, you and eight other retired Pima County judges. Why do you think it's worth it for you in your retirement to push for this, especially for a case, you know, that you carried out? Like, you did the sentencing here, right?
Yeah, I did, and that's a good question. All I can tell you is that for 44 years in my career, both as a prosecutor and as a judge, I was dedicated to achieving justice within the criminal justice system, both in the state and federal systems. And it's really disturbing to me in this case to have been the instrument of injustice. This to me is clearly an injustice, and it's an affront to my sense of justice, and that's been my whole career.
All right, we'll leave it there. John Leonardo, retired Pima County Superior Court judge, as well as former U.S. Attorney for the District of Arizona, joining us to talk more about this case. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for taking the time to talk us through this. I really appreciate it.
You're certainly welcome, Norm.
Phoenix continues to set heat records this summer, but other communities have also seen an increase in the impacts of extreme heat. And my next guest says she's seen a sea change over the last 5 years or so, with a dramatic increase in the level of interest across all kinds of communities worldwide in taking this issue on, including in some places that haven't really had to worry too much about heat as a threat before. Sarah Miro is an associate professor in the School of Geographical Sciences and Urban Planning at ASU and co-leads the new National Center for Heat Resilient Communities. She joins me to talk about this. And Sarah, do you find policymakers are taking their specific needs into account? It just seems like there's not really such a one-size-fits-all approach. For example, a place like Miami is very hot, but also very humid, whereas Phoenix is not. So you'd probably need a different action in different places. Are cities doing that or trying more to do one of those one-size-fits-all approaches?
I think that there is this recognition that heat is contextual, as you gave those examples. But I will also say that in some of the research that we've been doing, where we've been looking at city plans to see how they're addressing heat and what kinds of strategies they're using, we do see a lot of similarities in the approaches. And so I would say that there probably is additional room for customization and, you know, contextualization moving forward.
One of the things I think is really interesting that you write about is the fact that people really need to work together in different departments, different areas of expertise to really make a difference. That if you just have, for example, city planners trying to deal with this, you're not going to get the maximum result as if you have sort of an all of government approach.
Absolutely. So heat is a complex hazard. And these different sectors and different departments, say within a particular community, have been dealing with aspects of heat. But what I think has been really missing, and it's just now we're starting to see some emergence of this, is a really holistic approach to actually addressing heat, right? So developing a comprehensive heat strategy for a community, or having a dedicated, you know, chief heat officer who will try to actually bring together the public health dimensions of heat, the built environment or, you know, urban infrastructure aspects of heat, the climate modeling, right? All of these different components. So yeah, I think that's really, really critical. And the reality is we have often had a more siloed, separated approach to dealing with heat. And I think this is a barrier to really efficiently and effectively addressing it.
So you mentioned that you're seeing a lot of similarities, and I'm wondering if in those similarities, are they the right things? Are they are cities and their leaders doing the kinds of things that they ought to be doing that really make the most difference? Or are they just kind of doing the things that sound good or look good or people think work, but maybe there isn't enough data to suggest they actually do?
It's hard to say what works or what doesn't work, because it really depends what your goal is, right? And this is something that we talk about in this paper, is that, you know, if your goal is, you know, really trying to reduce heat deaths in the short term, then it's probably not going to be extremely effective to have your main strategy be planting tiny saplings, right? Because those trees are going to take time to grow large, to actually provide shade, to really be effective at heat mitigation. But if your goal is, hey, let's really try to improve the livability and comfortable temperatures, the thermal comfort of our community in the long term, well, then planting those trees might be quite advantageous. And so, again, I think it's really important to just be very clear about what is our goal. Is our goal, you know, short-term heat death reductions or heat illness reductions, or is it the long-term comfort of our community? And this will probably point to different strategies, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess that kind of raises the question of what kinds of goals are you seeing communities setting, and do you think they are the right goals?
Yeah, great question. I think there's a lot of discussion around urban heat islands, right? And trying to reduce the urban heat island. And I think that this idea of the urban heat island effect, the fact that cities, urban areas may be hotter than surrounding areas or natural areas, has really captured a lot of attention. But there's also been some criticism that just trying to, say, reduce those differences between some average temperature within a city versus outside of the city, that this may not actually be the most important goal if what we're trying to do is really, say, reduce heat-related illnesses or deaths, right? And so I think that's one area where, you know, it's important to just really, really think about that. But I do think ultimately that is that many communities do have, you know, reducing heat illnesses or deaths as, you know, a very important primary goal. And so I think that is critical. I certainly do not disagree with that one as something to focus on, right? I would say another one that, you know, my question is just pure tree planting goals, as opposed to maybe thinking about the potential for other ways of providing shade. This is something that that has been identified as well as, you know, potentially a limitation is that, you know, again, because trees take many years often to grow, to really provide shade, that it can be important to think about, you know, forms of built shade too, right? And how we might actually design our buildings to provide shade to pedestrians down below. So I think that thinking about these kinds of additional strategies is important. So for example, the city of Phoenix has transitioned from previously they had a tree and shade master plan, and the latest sort of iteration is much more focused on shade, which includes trees as a very important part of providing that shade, but also considers built shade as well.
Right. So we've been talking almost exclusively about the role of government, but I'm wondering what roles other sectors have, for example, the private sector, the nonprofit sector, philanthropies, you know, entities like that. Do they have a role here as well?
Absolutely. When we talk about heat governance, we make it very clear that we're not just talking about government, right? It's about how society collectively addresses heat risks. And this is going to include nonprofits. This is going to include community organizations. And the private sector is also a huge player. I mean, the built environment, so how our communities are actually developed, the infrastructure, the buildings, right, are going to play a really important role. And so developers who actually construct those and design those are really critical actors. And I actually think that's one area where an opportunity, right, to actually provide more guidance to the private sector, to developers, in terms of, you know, getting them to actually consider how their designs and what they're implementing might affect heat.
All right. That is Sarah Miro, an associate professor in ASU School of Geographical Sciences and Urban Planning. Sarah, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a Mesa author explores her family's connection to Native American boarding schools in her latest novel for young adults.
But first,
there will be a long list of ballot measures for you to vote on come November, from expanding abortion rights to giving local law enforcement immigration powers. But while you might not have heard of it yet, there will also be another hot button issue on your ballot. Homelessness. Proposition 312 would refund property owners some of their property tax payments if a city fails to enforce public nuisance laws like loitering, panhandling, and illegal camping, the same kinds of laws that are often broken by people experiencing homelessness. Just last week, an appeals court upheld a major decision on homelessness here in Phoenix, the one in which a judge ordered the city to dismantle the Zone, the city's large homeless encampment downtown that was known for all kinds of public nuisances. But our next guest this morning says this measure will do more to send a political message than fix a real homelessness need. Abe Kwok is an opinion columnist for the Arizona Republic, and he joins editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning to talk more about it. Good morning, Abe. Elvia.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, and Abe, let's start with you and your critique of this measure. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I think it's always bad public policy to create laws based on one particular case. And that's essentially what we have here. This is a response to the area or the encampment called the Zone, just west of downtown. And as most people know, the last 2-3 years, there was a huge number of people setting up camp and pitching tents and setting up temporary structures and living off in the streets, hundreds of them. At one point, I think topping 1,000 people. And that created just a lot of havoc for the area of businesses and some residential owners in that largely industrial area. And I believe it was in 2022, they sued the city for not enforcing the laws, the public nuisance laws. They were having people loitering. They were having people urinating and defecating and open drug use. And so this is a response to that. But I think the argument against this proposition is that this matter has been settled in court, first by a Superior Court judge and then affirmed by the appellate courts. And so this is really unnecessary.
Almia, let me turn to you and ask you about the idea here. Like, is it a bad idea, you think, to allow people who own property and are in these kinds of circumstances, whether it's people in the zone or in a neighborhood where people are, you know, camping in the alley, things like that? Like, is it a bad idea to allow them to have some recourse?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, from my point of view, what we're seeing here is a power grab by the state legislature, but the Republican state legislature, to control what cities can do and not do, essentially take away their power in dealing with their own issues. So I don't agree with this proposition for that reason. But on the other hand, you know, I keep thinking about this idea of why do property owners pay taxes to begin with. Mm. So there is a discussion to be had. I mean, we pay property taxes on homes and, you know, and on businesses, and then that money goes into a fund, into a general fund of different cities. In return, cities and municipalities are responsible for protecting the public safety, for better roads, for all the stuff that comes with being a city government. The city of Phoenix absolutely failed property owners, business owners, and homeowners, right? Residents around it. So there is a bigger discussion to be had about what is the responsibility. We don't pay property taxes, either businesses or homeowners, to get what we want, right? We send it to a general fund for that collective good. Mm-hmm. But we do have to make sure the city governments are responsible for maintaining the public good, and, you know, not just for businesses, but for residents as well. My biggest concern here, as you can see, there are many, you know, with the zone, you know, it doesn't exist anymore, not in downtown, but that doesn't mean that the Adams House have disappeared. They're somewhere. Yeah. You know, they're somewhere around Phoenix or around the valley. And so where are they? Who's dealing with them? I mean, they just shifted the situation to someone else.
Right. So, Abe, along those lines, like, let me ask you about that, because you're saying, you know, this only affects a very few homeowners in a specific area. It's only about the zone. But is it only about the zone anymore now that the zone has been cleaned up? And as Elvia points out, like, these folks have probably kind of scattered across the valley and may be affecting other people's homes.
Yeah, it's a point well taken. And I do think the problem is in the enforcement of this proposition. You know, cities and towns would pretty much be put on the defensive. They either can approve the application for a property tax break, or they can challenge it and say, this is not worthy, reject it. And that would put the burden on the plaintiff to file a legal action. Cities, it's like waiting a day to clean up a mess in front of somebody's private property. You know, do they even have an obligation to? You know, if police is not responding within a certain number of hours, does that constitute a failure to enforce the law? So I think this opens up a can of worms for both the property owners as well as for, you know, municipalities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let me ask you lastly, both of you, but I'll start with you, Elvia. I mean, the idea here, right, your critique, Abe, is that this is not the right fix, but there is a problem. What do you both think the better solution would be? I mean, should it be more shelter? Should it be more community services? How would you rather us, you know, as a community address this kind of issue?
No, that's a larger question, and I think the biggest one. Abe, in his column, is asking whether local governments are so unresponsive that they're likely to repeat Phoenix's failure. And my answer to that is, in some cases, yes. And we have seen it, right? Not just with the unhoused situation, but with many situations. So what can possibly be done if not this, right? I do not have a specific answer. but it is something that we need to discuss. I don't necessarily like this proposition because it is a power grab. But on the other hand, we have a problem, and someone has to be responsive.
A couple of thoughts. One is the timing, right? This was sent to the ballot by the legislature back in early spring, in March, long before the appellate court said, hey, city, you guys, your appeal doesn't resonate. You guys don't have a leg to stand on. And then secondly, there was a Supreme Court ruling this summer that basically said, hey, cities, you have the power to enforce anti-camping, anti-public nuisance laws, and you don't need to demonstrate that the homeless don't have a shelter to go to, and just enforce the law. And so I think municipalities, including Phoenix, probably heard loud and clear that message. And so the question then just becomes, what can they do to prevent another massive encampment that would just flood back into the area and create havoc?
Mm-hmm. We will leave it there for now. Abe Kwok, columnist at the Arizona Republic, joining editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning. Thank you both for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. A significant court ruling is expected tomorrow in a dispute over taxes between the European Union and Apple. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. And Jonathan, what exactly is this case about?
Well, this is a case that's been running for years. And back in 2016, the European Commission, which is the executive arm of the European Union, ruled that Ireland's tax arrangements with Apple were incompatible with EU internal market rules. The Commission ordered Ireland to recover 13 billion euros in back taxes, plus around €1 billion in interest. Apple paid the sum into what's known as an escrow account while the ruling was challenged. A slew of US technology companies have their European headquarters based in Ireland because of what's perceived as a beneficial tax regime in the country. It has one of the lowest corporation tax rates in the European Union. So if profits are booked there, companies stand to pay a lot less than they would otherwise in taxes on profits. But the Irish government had also issued tax rulings to Apple in 1991 and 2007, which approved how Apple would treat their chargeable profits in the country, in which the EU alleged amounted to illegal state aid. It's those rulings that the EU has been challenging. Now, back in 2020, the European Union's General Court, a component of the Court of Justice based in Luxembourg, overturned the Commission's ruling that Apple should pay Ireland the back taxes. And it's that decision that's subsequently been appealed, and which we'll get a ruling on tomorrow.
So what are the options for what might happen next?
Well, last November, a European Court of Justice Advocate General issued a legal opinion that the court should set aside the General Court's judgment and refer it back to that court for a new decision, meaning Apple may eventually be forced to pay up. The Advocate General argued that the General Court had made a series of errors in law in its ruling. While the Advocate General's opinion is not binding, in most cases, their legal opinion is followed by the higher court. Ireland's government has long maintained that it has no special deals with individual companies, including Apple. But if the Court of Justice rules against Ireland and Apple's perspective, it could be a fairly significant setback both for the country and the technology giant. So it will certainly be interesting to see how it all pans out.
Yeah, that does sound interesting. Okay, Jonathan, let's move now to Wednesday, where the UN Security Council will be voting on whether to renew sanctions against Sudan. That country has faced a civil war lasting more than a year now. What is the latest on that?
Well, Sudan's civil war began in April last year when the army and their former paramilitary allies, the Rapid Support Forces, began a vicious struggle for power, in part over proposals to move towards civilian rule. The war, which shows no signs of ending, has claimed thousands of lives, displaced millions of people, and plunged parts of the country into famine. Aid agencies are warning that Sudan could soon experience the worst famine of anywhere in the world unless significantly more help arrives. Every day, dozens of Sudanese refugees cross the border into Chad, many of them women carrying their hungry and thirsty children on their backs. The World Food Programme, meanwhile, says it delivered hundreds of thousands of tons of food since the conflict began, but both sides are accused of blocking aid deliveries into areas under rival control. The army and the RSF have both previously denied such accusations. So it's a really messy situation. It's that backdrop against which the Security Council will be voting whether to renew its arms embargo on the warring parties in the country, which is something that looks very likely to happen.
But Jonathan, it's true, right, that there are accusations that a number of countries are actually breaching that embargo.
Yeah, just today, Human Rights Watch has said that Sudan's warring parties have obtained more foreign-made weapons and military equipment despite the UN arms embargo. A report based on videos and photos posted by fighters on social media reveals their stock includes armed drones, anti-tank missiles, drone jammers, and multi-barrel rocket launchers. The equipment was manufactured last year, raising concerns about how it was all acquired. The weapons originate in China, Iran, Russia, Serbia, and the United Arab Emirates. And both Iran and the UAE stand accused of supplying drones to the warring sides in the conflict. Drone expert Wim Zwijnenberg has told the BBC that footage of army drones spotted in a number of contexts indicate they'd come from Iran. Attempts by the BBC to ask the army, Iran's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and the airline involved were met with silence, though a member of Sudan's Sovereign Council claimed the country does not receive weapons from any party. Meanwhile, Amnesty International alleges that the United Arab Emirates has been supplying the paramilitary rapid support forces with quadcopter drones made from commercial components capable of dropping 120mm mortar shells. And according to a UN report presented to the Security Council earlier this year, aviation tracking experts observed a civilian aircraft airbridge allegedly transporting weapons from the UAE to the RSF. That's an allegation that the UAE denies. The UAE says these flights have not been transporting weapons, arguing that they were delivering humanitarian aid instead. It says the country is committed to seeking a, quote, peaceful solution to the ongoing conflict. But irrespective of the sanctions vote this week, the conflict in Sudan does not look like it's going to be resolved anytime soon, although last week the UN called for an independent and impartial force to be deployed to the country. The fact-finding mission that reached that conclusion also argued that the Sudanese army and the rapid support forces had targeted civilians through indiscriminate airstrikes, rape, arbitrary arrest, and torture, acts that in themselves might amount to war crimes.
Right. Okay, so Jonathan, later in the week, there's going to be a NATO Chiefs of Defense meeting in the Czech capital of Prague. What is on the agenda there?
Well, this is a gathering of NATO's highest military authority, the Military Committee. The aim is to discuss military strategic developments within the alliance. In essence, it's a kind of stocktake of progress made since July's NATO summit in Washington. One of the most memorable moments in that gathering came on the final day when President Biden introduced Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky as President Putin before quickly correcting himself. Although quite a lot has happened since then, not least, of course, the replacement of Joe Biden on the Democratic ticket for November's presidential election with his Vice President Kamala Harris. And this week's gathering is more likely to focus on how NATO can continue to support Ukraine in its war with Russia. Ukraine continues to call for the right to use long-range weapons provided by its Western allies against targets in Russia, though that's something that the U.S. is continuing to resist for now.
Is there a chance that the U.S. presidential election could come up with the NATO allies this week?
Well, a theme that emerged at July's NATO summit was concern from some members of the alliance about how to handle the possibility of Donald Trump being re-elected as U.S. president, and discussions on that may be happening on the sidelines this weekend. Four members of visiting delegations, asking to remain anonymous, told the BBC at the time that their concern was not that a Trump administration would withdraw entirely from NATO, as he's previously threatened, rather that the U.S. commitment to the alliance's core principle of collective security, all for one and one for all, if you like, could wane. Donald Trump's positions have veered from outright hostility, implying that the alliance is made up of sort of freeloading Europeans surviving off protection paid for by US taxpayers, to suggesting that his outbursts are more part of a negotiating tactic aimed at compelling more of the alliance's members to meet its defense spending targets. But his perspective on NATO is clearly a concern for some members.
Interesting. All right. That is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. Jonathan, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. A Valley company is trying to make robotics more accessible and affordable to students. EcoRobotic was founded by Gabriela Gabaldon, a former teacher. The program includes classes, camps, and competitions, and tries to keep costs down and focus on sustainability. I spoke with Gabaldon earlier and asked what got her started on robotics.
Well, the thing is that I was a teacher here, as I mentioned, and then I love robotics, you know, being a teacher in all different sciences. But I saw that there was a problem in which there are amazing out there robotics companies that have opportunities, however, they are very expensive. Me as an immigrant, thinking about there are not everywhere can purchase these kind of kits. And my thought was, how can we make it more affordable? That was the first thought. The second thought is like sustainability piece. It should be something that in every lesson should have just a little bit of what the purpose of robotics, because I know us out there thinking like, oh, technology and sustainability should not be together. No. It actually should be together in order to be more sustainable. And then, so that is basically the bottom line. I never thought, like 20 years ago, thinking about I'm going to start entrepreneurship. I did study environmental chemistry. I studied engineering. I love teaching those three things. But there was no solution out there. I said, you know what? I just, who likes this idea? Who joins me into this idea? And so a group of friends, you know, joined together to start EcoRobotics. So
how do you try to make robotics more affordable? Like, how do you try to get more kids to be able to do this who maybe don't have the means to buy an expensive kit?
Well, so there are different kits out there. There are main companies, for the people that knows about robotics competitions, that are amazing, don't get me wrong. However, they are super expensive. They are big robots, have very high tech, and which is great. However, there are other things that not necessarily has to be purchased from us. So there are things that, talking about sustainability. So you can use some piece that, oh, I have this leftover radio that we never use. So we can use some parts of that to create and build your robot. That makes it more affordable, thinking about I can repurpose some materials to build your robot.
So do you then sell the kits that are maybe missing a few pieces and say, here's where you can get this transistor, here's where you can get this piece, you know, if you have this at home, or, you know, maybe you can find this somewhere? Or like, how does that work in terms of trying to encourage people to use repurposed parts while also encouraging sustainability?
Well, we do sell the kit. However, we do sell the basic kit. So you see here, one here, there's a basic kit. However, they're add-ons. The robot won't have an arm. The robot doesn't have, you know, doesn't have the claw. The robot, if you're using a robot a lot, especially a kid, things will break. So now that we understand what the purpose of that piece, you can solder. You can, you know, can put it together. Maybe you can use a different kind of wheel than we have from an old toy in Goodwill. So we can put rubber bands. So now that you understand, you don't have to every time purchase something new. We can repurpose those other things at the house.
Is there something in some way that's maybe more educational if you don't just get the kit with all the pieces, where you kind of have to figure out, okay, how I'd like to add this on, how am I going to do that? What am I going to use and how am I going to attach it? That kind of thing. Does that kind of get the creative juices flowing a little bit?
Yeah, the problem solving. So totally. You know, one of the things that sometimes with our phones, the kid's cell phone being always like just everything is given to you. So I want something, just Google, give it to me. However, now that creative mind, okay, now I don't have the pieces in my house. So now it's forced them to actually research, do a little research. Oh, if I want to put an arm. So that is basically that creative thinking is so important. That is what encouraged. It's part of the lesson, actually.
Why is it so important, do you think, that more kids have the opportunity to get into robotics? Like, what is it about doing this and building these that helps them maybe in other areas?
Well, robotics is puts together three different fields. So you have the mechanics, you have the electronics, and you have the programming. So it's starting from there. And here, for example, if we talk about in Arizona, we have a lot of boom with semiconductors. This is a lot of companies are coming here. We have you know, different businesses coming here, moving from California to Arizona. We need a lot of workforce that knows tech. Whether it's, you know, programming, whether it's, you know, the mechanics portion, the electronics, and robotics put all these three fields more together. So when a kid is exposed to robotics in a fine way, obviously, but exploring these fields have the opportunity to be able to be a worker.
So you talked about how there are other companies out there that, you know, kids can do robotics with that are a little more expensive, or maybe a lot more expensive, mm-hmm. than what you have. How important is it to sort of level the playing field and make it so that students who maybe don't have a lot of means are still able to do activities like these?
Yeah, you know, it's totally important. For example, the companies, as you mentioned, that are cost more. Sometimes when you're in school, think about the kids have the options of, you know, playing football, playing, you know, volleyball, which require a lot of time after school. then if you want to join a robotics club and you want to be part of this specific competition, which are wonderful, but the idea is that if my child plays soccer, okay, if they go one time a week, they can start learning a robot. It doesn't have to be so big or complicated, but have the basics of robotics. Mm-hmm. So that is why it's so important, not just the money, it's just also the time as well. Then the kids nowadays have involved in different things.
Right. All right. That is Gabriela Gabaldon, founder of Eco Robotic. Gabriela, nice to meet you. Thank you so much.
No, thank you so much, Mark.
Violet Duncan is an author based in Mesa. She's published 4 books illuminating the Native American experience through a variety of lenses. But while her first 3 books were picture books, her latest is a young adult novel about a Native woman reckoning with the legacy of the residential schools program, which separated generations of Indigenous children from their families. The book is called Buffalo Dreamer, and it tells the story of Summer, a young girl who begins having dreams about a runaway from a residential school. As Summer begins to recognize the connection between her dreams and her own family's story, her understanding of herself and her community is transformed forever. Duncan got the idea for the book in 2021 when she was quarantining at home with her children. That spring, news broke that the remains of over 200 children had been discovered at the Kamloops Indian Residential School in Canada. As Duncan recently told the show's Sam Dingman, she felt completely bowled over by the tragedy.
And my children were like right in my face, "Why are you crying? What's going on? What's happening? What are you reading?" And I'm like, "Oh my gosh, give me some space." And I had to explain to them what I was reading and why it was making me sad.
Yeah.
And they were like, "Residential school? Why would they have to go? And what did they do there? And what happened to them?" And after I kind of explain in kid version the horrific things that happened to those children, I just slipped in that my father went. So saying, "Your mushum attended, your Japon, AKA your great grandmother attended." And I didn't expect that to blow their minds and be like, "What?" They mm-hmm. thought this was like hundreds of years ago. And I was like, "Yeah, your grandfather did go through this. And this is why he's sensitive to certain topics."
Yeah.
So that's kind of like what inspired it.
Wow. So one of the most compelling elements of the book for me is the way in which the elders in Summer's family, they sometimes drop hints about what they've been through in terms of their experience at the residential schools. But there's always a bit of tension that Summer feels about how much it's okay to ask about and whether or not it's going to be something that they want to talk about. But then there's also this idea that the story needs to be told so that the younger generations in the family will know that this really happened. Is that a dynamic that you had to navigate with your parents and grandparents?
And still do, yeah. Mm-hmm. And instead of saying tension, I would say caution, that we never know what is going to be triggering. Mm-hmm. And when our relatives are triggered, it sometimes takes weeks to heal because there's been no real healing work.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we do want to talk with them about it, you designate the day to spend with them. We're not going to visit Cookham from 2 to 4 and ask her about storytelling. It's like, all right, let's bring food, you know, wherever she needs to go. Mm-hmm. Whatever she wants to go garage sale hopping, she wants to go grocery shopping, she wants to go pick sweetgrass. That's what we're going to do. And as we spend the day with her, we can ask the questions, and if this question arises, you know, that will naturally come.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I have some experience in asking folks in families about traumatic incidents from their past because of a previous project that I worked on. And one of the things that I remember being difficult about it is that these are the kinds of things that people aren't equipped to just give you a succinct, coherent narrative about. Because these are memories that oftentimes they've either repressed or been compelled to suppress.
Yep. And that was also a part of it, because my kids would say, "Can we ask Mushum what happened?" And I would say, "Sure. How do you want to ask him?" And that would allow them to think like, "Yeah, how do I want to ask him?"
Yeah.
And so when they did talk to him, I saw when they found their moment, and it wasn't like when it was ideal, like mm-hmm. in the morning with his coffee. It was like when they were brushing the horses. Musham, did you used to ride a horse when you were a little boy? And, oh, yeah. How little were you? Oh, I started riding when I was 12. What about when you're my age, you know, 8 years old, seven? And that would kind of prompt him to say, oh, okay, well, when I was seven, that's different.
Oh, so that was without coaching. You just kind of said, go spend the time with him. And all you gave them was the encouragement to think, how do you want to ask? Just to even think about that question.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you remember how you began to receive this history for yourself?
Well, I was really lucky. I learned about residential school probably when I was in grade two. And that's because both of my parents were in university and they were pursuing their fine arts masters. And so they were writing scripts and they were using historical stories to share in those scripts. And they would always have a scene that was the residential school scene. And it would be a nun or a priest cutting a child's hair and everybody kind of in the same uniform. And so most of these plays were unscripted. So it was all mm-hmm. through dance and movement and music. And so it was up to your own interpretation. But I was privy to the director, my mom. And I'd be like, what is happening? What is that? And grade two and grade three, I remember my mom saying, that's a residential school. That's where kids were forced to go, like your dad.
Right. But there's this interesting way I'm just realizing as we're talking about it that your parents were creating somewhat fictionalized expressions of their own history in the form of these dances. And now you're kind of doing the same thing in creating this fictionalized version of your experience of approaching the understanding of this truth with caution.
Yeah.
So there's a real through line there.
Yeah, you know, I never even saw it like that. Because when I was writing it, I didn't know what I was doing with this story. All I knew is that it was healing to write it down. And it's so parallel to my life. Like,
yeah.
Honestly, my dad ran away from the school a lot of times.
Oh, wow.
And one was a particularly terrible blizzard. And he told me about that time. And I think they were walking for like 5 hours, him and a friend. And they were really confident that they were going to get home. And finally a car came and they were like, oh, finally, you know, we can get warm. And mm-hmm. and car picked them up and it was the priest. And they turned around and sent them right back to the school. And I was like, oh, what if he got away? And so this book was like, what if? What if he made it home?
Wow. You know, I have to say, reading, there is, I don't think this is giving away too much, there is a blizzard scene for a runaway in the book that is extremely harrowing to read. And so hearing that it's based on a true story just sort of undergirds the emotional experience of reading it. And one of my favorite scenes actually in the book that to me illustrates this is the scene where I believe it is Summer's parents go to see an elder in the community named Cookham Rose, and Summer has been having these dreams where this story of one of the other elders of the community is being revealed to her, but she doesn't know how to make sense of it yet. And so Cookham Rose looks at Summer and she says, you have a visitor. And she can tell that Summer has been having these, I don't know if she literally knows it's dreams, but she can tell that something is going on. Can you tell me a little bit about how you came up with that scene? I think it's my favorite scene from the whole book.
Thank you. It's one of my favorites as well because, surprise, Cookham Rose is inspired by my mom.
Okay.
My mom is, her name is Rosa.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So that's Cookham Rose. My mom has this emotional intelligence mm-hmm. where she just, and I've met a couple other people like that who just, you don't have to explain yourself. They just get it. My mom is constantly have tea on the stove, ready to pour uh-huh. tea. Anybody right. who comes up the driveway, we have a long driveway so we can see who's driving up for a long way on the res, and we're, oh, somebody's coming, put the tea on. Mm-hmm. And it's always been a safe place to come to my parents' house, whether mm-hmm. you're a kid, an elder, a teenager, a naughty one. that was the safe place to drop in And sometimes it would be like, something's bothering me, nobody believes me. And my mom was just like, I believe you.
Wow. Well, Violet Duncan is the author of Buffalo Dreamer. Violet, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Kisagitin and Askomen people, thank you so much for listening.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.